Hello and welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where this week we are not diving into a single great film, but instead exploring a theme that I think has been central to filmmaking and storytelling for thousands of years. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Rocha. I'm a writer, producer, and host here in San Diego, California, and former Catholic, I guess I would say, but lover of religious film. So I'm excited to have this conversation in lieu of our initial thoughts, which was part one of The Last Temptation of Christ, which is coming next week.
Well, that's right. And this is, you know, we initially were the month of a filmmaker, and then it became the season of a filmmaker. And I think in this case, with four films from Martin Scorsese, we are truly a full season.
Yeah.
And it was a lot to deal with. And we kind of went, as we were talking about Last Temptation of Christ off the mic, The subject of just religious films in general came up, and it was your idea. Like, what if we devote a whole episode to just discussing this theme? And I'm so excited about the idea. Yeah. And I think it's something maybe we'll do more in the future, because it gives you sort of an opportunity to step back a bit and kind of look at not just great films that we love, but also the more I thought about it, the more I went, man, religious and religious ideas and ideas of faith, those things have deep, deep connection to all sorts of films, even films that don't seem quite religious. And I wanted to share one other thing, which is one of the reasons I've sort of been rearranging some pieces of my life is that there is a project I've started working on that is fundamentally about religion. And this is, as everyone who listens to the show probably knows, I'm an atheist, but I'm an atheist who has been fascinated by religion my whole life. Mm. And all of the things I've been thinking about for 30 years, I've finally gone, I need to put this into writing. It's currently called The Faith Project, and it is something that I will be working on for several years to come. It is a large project, but it is definitely, you know, thinking and reading and studying religion has been pretty central to my life for a long time now. And so this is me trying to put some of those thoughts into words. So I'm not going to go into what the project is, but I wanted to share that because so much of what we're about to talk about is things I've been thinking about a lot.
Yeah.
And John, I would like to start at an unusual place, which is what you just mentioned, that you were formerly a Catholic. So I wanted to hear not just how were you raised, like were you taken to church every week, all that stuff, but also how did you feel? Did you believe it was 100% true? Were you deeply moved by those stories? What was your relation to religion as a kid?
Well, it's a great question, and thank you for asking. So from the beginning, I grew up in a very religious household, and by that I mean my father was constantly reading the Bible, even on Sundays. If he wasn't going to church, he was reading the Bible. If he had some time in the afternoon on a day off from the work, he was reading the Bible. So I would catch him all the time up in the living room, for lack of a better term, the bay window with the book open, rather the Bible open, and him reading silently, finger on his cheek, intently reading the Bible. Because this is something that for him, who grew up with such a difficult childhood, with having his father die at 10 years old, having his stepfather come in and be physically abusive and a drunk, having his mom be a bit, not a doting mom. There was a lot of damage inside my father. And so when he ran away from home at 16 years old, after getting into a scrape with the military there in Bolivia, that particular government at that time, and Bolivia's had 176 revolutions through its history, probably more than that. He was not allowed to come back until the regime changed over, and that was 17 years later. So during that time, he was in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and that's where he really kind of found the power of God for himself. And so it was a very big thing for him to use the Bible and religion to help him maintain his strength, help him to believe in himself, help him to fight through tough moments and believe that there was more. So when I was born, I was very much born into a family, into a domineering father who had this point of view about religion, right? My mother, very religious as well, but not in the same way. She go to church, all of that growing up, but she came from a much more wealthier house, much more relaxed upbringing, very loving upbringing, completely different upbringing than my father. So from my birth, I mean, I remember I was baptized. I remember going to Sunday school very early back in Colmore, Virginia. And then when we moved to Dale City, we were going to church, you know, every Sunday at Holy Family Catholic Church. But around my teen years, my father became very disillusioned with the church itself, not with religion, because he felt there was a lot of hypocrisy, a lot of two-facedness, and at times a bit of racism, because they would push the people of who were Spanish in a certain section of the church, ooh, and then other people who were not in other sections of the church closer to the priest. So this is his perception, right? And so for him, this is where he started to lose his connection with religion. He was like, we're all praising and shaking hands and hugging each other in church, and then we're honking horns and yelling at each other, trying to leave the parking lot. So religion doesn't last even 10 minutes. And so these are these things that, for my father, he eventually became, I think he became a theologian about religion, in that he moved away from the constriction of religion and church and moved more into faith-based approach to his belief, and read the Bible and watched stories and all this kind of stuff. So for me, it was a very big part of my life. And I believed, like, I believed very strongly that I had a connection to God. We're veering into a place where, like, I want to say things, but say things that people don't think are arrogant. But when I was younger, I used to think that I was one of the blessed ones. Like, I had a feeling like I was different from everybody else. And I was certainly beat up many, many times because I was different from everybody else. But I also felt like God had put his finger on me, put his hand on me for whatever reasons, right? I can't explain it. I just haven't always felt that way. So I always felt a very strong connection to him. And so going to Sunday school, going to the Catholic Youth Organization, meetups and things of that nature. I went to religious Catholic school for a year in sixth grade, St. Francis of Assisi. And so it was a very big part of my life. But just like my father, I also had a break probably at 18 years old from the church and just focused more on God and God and my faith. And I removed the church from my life because I felt it was something that was a middleman, and I didn't need a middleman in connection with God and talking to God. And it's no judgment for anybody else who does. So religion for me became that, my conversations with God. When I was in the military, I had a Bible on me all the time, those little green Bibles they gave you. And so I was always called the Reverend. That was my nickname when I was in the military, because I was always reading the New Testament, never the Old Testament, always the New Testament, about love and connection and forgiveness. And also for me, it was a strong way for me to get through the military, because I was very scared, very nervous in the military, very intimidated by the military. But I never had any problems because people knew I was a person of faith. And so people would come and talk to me and we'd have conversations. And so religion has been a very big, big part of my life. And I, you know, when the things happened in 2016, where I almost took my life, I think was a very big deal to have that religion background and have that faith to kind of help. It wasn't the only thing that helped, but it was certainly a part of what helped me kind of get back on my feet. So yeah, religion has been a very, very huge part of my life. And religious movies, especially, which is what we're going to talk about here, Steve, with Ten Commandments and Ben-Hur and Jesus of Nazareth, the series. And so to me, that's what I grew up on, when religious films and religious TV shows were much more mainstream than you see nowadays, and were accepted to be much more mainstream than you see nowadays. And I feel like it was a golden age of religious themed content in movies and TV shows.
So first of all, thank you for sharing all that. There was a lot of stuff you shared that I really didn't know. I didn't know about your father in Buenos Aires. I didn't know. I knew a little bit, but I'm really glad you shared that. I'm curious, what was it about reading the New Testament that gave you comfort when you were in the army? What specifically?
Yeah. I think just the conversations of forgiveness and acceptance and love and the new covenant and this idea of not turning from God. And it isn't, and I never found judgment in the Bible. Like, I never found judgment of, like, oh, gays are this, or people are this, or women are this. To me, in the New Testament, it's very much about humbling yourself, even to people who society deems to be the lowest class of people, right? The having Mary Magdalene wash his feet, him washing the feet of a prostitute, him telling the tax collector to stop collecting the taxes and to follow him. And so there was a lot of mess, whipping the moneylenders out of the church. So for me, God and religion is a very massive part of the construction of John Rocha. And so when I see it being bastardized or misused, or people use it conveniently for their own benefits, financially and otherwise, it really rankles me. And when people think that they are representing God and religion with their actions, when they're really representing greed and avarice, it really starts to frustrate me very deeply, because I find such power in Jesus's words, and I find such strength in Jesus's words. And whether you believe in Jesus Christ or not, which of course everyone has a right to believe what they want to believe, I think that there is some real power and lessons and knowledge in those stories, no matter who wrote them. But in those stories, I find such incredible knowledge, power, and guidelines. And so I found that when I was struggling in the military, when I was scared of the military, I would surrender my strength to God in my heart. Like, I'd be like, please, please take care of me in this moment. And, you know, I am ever your servant, and whatever you decide, I will follow this path. And so I was always finding strength and solace in that. Because clearly, Steve, I had a lot of self-esteem and self-worth issues from a teenage on to when things fell apart in 2016 that I hadn't quite come to terms with. And I think religion was a way to kind of find me, to kind of put a Band-Aid or some salve over those wounds.
It's so funny, and I don't mean funny, haha, obviously. Mm. The thing that I had to reckon with, the big lesson that I had to learn, and really the core of this project I'm working on, yeah, is, you know, as an atheist, I was just like, looked at religion like, well, that doesn't make sense. That's wrong. It's illogical or whatever. And so here I was telling people that their most cherished beliefs,
yeah,
that there was something wrong with it. And the thing that I had to reckon with, that you just shared exactly the point, is religion works.
Yeah.
It works for people.
It does. Yeah.
And that I think where atheists get hung up is they just want to talk about whether or not it's right or it's true or not. Right. And that truth is like, that's like the teeniest tip of the iceberg of how profound these sets of beliefs are. I have one more question for you, and then I'll share some of my own background, sure, about it. Please. But when you said that you felt this connection to God, and you're going to church as a little kid, yeah, is that where you felt the connection? And did you particularly feel connection to those stories? Like, did they feel really real for you, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I never, obviously, well, I won't say I never. As a child, obviously, you accept the story of Jonah and the whale and those kinds of things. But I think for me, it was more a matter of when I was a child, it was feeling like there was some, because I mean, you know, my dad could be a difficult dad with all the religious aspect of it all. My father was still at times, he would spank me. There was at times some very harsh fights in our house growing up, as my dad was a very passionate man. I don't know where I get that from. But, you know, there was a feeling like there is a better father out there, an overall better father out there that I can surrender myself to, that I can seek guidance from. And my dad was great. Don't get me wrong. My dad was great in trying. In retrospect, I can see some of the lessons he was really trying to teach me, although he didn't have the emotional vocabulary or the emotional intelligence to necessarily get that across. His intention was to teach me and prepare me for life, and I can see that. But with God as a child, I found faith, which is why Amadeus and Salieri, in that moment,
oh, yeah,
praying to God, there are elements of that, right? My father wasn't as bad as Salieri's dad, but like, there were moments where I was like, I could turn to God as a father figure in a way and speak to him and feel at times, and not that I ever spoke to God. I'm not one of those people that believes that, but I could feel a calming presence. I could feel a calming energy, an energy come enter me in certain moments when I spoke with him that kind of soothed me.
Yeah.
And I'm in a state right now, to be honest with you, Steve, if we're going to be real honest, where I feel like I've lost that the last 2 or 3 years. And I am trying to find my connection back to God again in a new way, in who I am now as a person and the things that I'm doing as a person here in my life right now. So that's an element of some things that I'm kind of working through myself. So
I'll give you my one thought coming from an atheist, so take this with all the grains of salt you might want. But the thing I recently have been thinking about, and this is just parts of the faith project that I'm working on, is there's a reason that people call religion and faith a practice.
Yeah.
You have to practice it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Good point.
So I think personally,
yeah,
I think I came out of the womb an atheist. I really do. I really do. Like, I never believed in Santa Claus. I always loved, wow, I love the story, yeah, but I always just knew like, oh, this is like play acting. Here's this fun story that we're all involved in. My sister, I think, believed in Santa Claus. and I, much younger, 3.5 years younger than him, never did. I did. Judaism was exceptionally important to my family and still is growing up. But we came of this generation of very assimilated Jews who were out of the Reform movement, which there are all sorts of people, particularly Orthodox Jews, who would say, we're not even Jews. Like, they're so, you know, don't keep kosher, like, didn't, you know, wear yarmulkes in the temple necessarily. Like, very, I was super Reformed temple in San Francisco that my family had been a part of since the 1880s, you know, like the, and part of building this temple, Temple Emmanuel. I went to Sunday school every Sunday from 5 years old until high school and learned Jewish dances and Jewish cooking. And then, as we talked about recently, when we talked about Zone of Interest, indoctrinated into a certain kind of issues regarding the Holocaust and the state of Israel. And I can so remember around fifth grade being the kid who had his hand up saying, hold on a second, that doesn't make sense. You know, so I was already a pain in the ass, you know, at 9 or 10 years old. And I started to go like, this stuff doesn't make sense. But what I always loved and have always been drawn to is the stories. Always loved the stories. And this is the thought that I had, and I would like to some degree frame our conversation with this. Obviously, the conversation is going to go wherever it's going to go. But I suddenly went, and I'll only speak for a sort of European-centric culture, but there is a solid 1,000 years where all art is religious art. All the plays were religious plays. All the music was religious music, unless it was just popular music that people were playing around at the body house or whatever. And all the paintings were religious paintings. All the sculptures were religious sculptures. Right. And I think those core principles and those core storytelling, musical and visual devices, they're not just in religious films. Yeah. They're fucking everywhere. Right. Everywhere we and this is the thing, and I will start with the first movie I think you mentioned, which is the movie that I watched every single year at the same time because it's on TV. I had it practically memorized. I absolutely love it. I haven't seen it in a long time, and I kind of want to watch it again. Ooh. But that is the Ten Commandments. You know,
it is so funny you say that because I think I've ridden your universal wave the last couple of weeks. Because I've been in this very strong desire to rewatch the Ten Commandments. And I haven't felt that way in a very, very, very long time. Like, I used to watch it on ABC.
Yeah.
And they'd show it, right? I was with, we do the same thing in our house. So it's interesting that you're in that place as well. That's fascinating. I wonder if that means we should tackle it down the road or maybe.
You know what? We could do it as a watch along.
Yeah. I was thinking a watch along would be interesting for both of us. Yeah.
Because my guess, I haven't seen it in at least 20 years.
Ditto, probably. Yeah, probably about that time.
And my guess is I will remember every single thing in that movie because I watched it so much as a kid. and the thing, my favorite, so, but my family, we didn't generally go to Sabbath services every week. We did go to high holidays. But the most important holiday for me was Passover, first at my grandfather's house where he ran the service, and then at my dad, with my dad or my uncle. And like, when I'm reading through the Haggadah, you can bet I am picturing Yul Brynner and Charlton Heston in my head, you know, as that, because that is Passover to me, is that movie.
Moses and the Israelites. I love Yul Brynner in that movie.
He's great.
If you guys have never heard the bit of Billy Crystal from back in the 1980s talking about Ten Commandments, do yourself a favor and find that on YouTube. It's a fantastic little bit that he does on that movie and how the crazy casting of that film should have never worked, yet it totally works.
Yeah.
Nobody loves.
And then the next movie, which I also think you mentioned, which I think is a far better film, I have no memory of not knowing the movie Ten Commandments. I remember at 11 or 12, I think, first seeing Ben-Hur.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, isn't it fascinating how these films, Steve, work for both the Catholic and Jewish faith? I mean, it's fascinating how
they're in the Torah. I mean, they're at the right time. So,
yeah, and it's so genius because as a business, and listen, never forget, Hollywood is a business. You want to appeal, or you want to release these movies at a time when people are caught up in religion, and very much religion is the frontmost thing in people's minds, right? Whether it's said overtly or not. And so you want to be able to make a movie or put out a movie that will appeal to both Catholic and Jewish faiths so that you get the biggest cross-section of moviegoers who might go and take a look at this movie, or atheists like you who would go just if it's a good movie and Charlton Heston is in it, you know? So I think these were really smart moves by studios at the time to take advantage of that.
And I think they actually, it's so funny because both with Ten Commandments and Ben-Hur, mm-hmm. they have these huge elements of adventure to them, particularly Ben-Hur, obviously, with the chariot race. Yeah. But they're still really, really moving. And it's so funny. I remember the moment that I went, oh, the Last Supper is Passover. Like, mm-hmm. you know, as I started to learn how these are where these connections are. I'll tell you the next religious movie, 70s film, totally discovered it, you know, and watched it many, many, many times. Yeah. And that is Godspell.
Oh, yeah. I've never seen the movie Godspell. Wow. Okay.
I loved it. And it is such a 70s musical. It is as 70s a musical as you could get. And the fact that it's, what's his name? In the Superman who plays Jesus is Victor Garber.
Oh, really?
As Jesus, where? And I'll tell you the reason. Yes.
A young Victor Garber?
Go look. You now need to look up Victor Garber.
I must watch this film now.
I don't know if it'll hold. I think you'll like it, actually. You're looking at the picture?
Yes. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And Lynn Thigpen, who I love from Lean On Me and other things. Wow.
So it is the story of Jesus.
Yeah.
In like 70s New York with hippies and people, you know, it's like probably 1969 or 1970.
Right.
Running around New York. Each of the songs are like one of the parables. So you're hearing all the parables of Jesus as they run around. And this is really probably where my started to understand what Jesus was about is really through Godspell. And I totally, there was never any, I think maybe because, like I said, I think I was born an atheist.
Yeah.
I never felt any contradiction between being a Jewish kid who loved the story of Jesus.
Right.
Because it is a great story. It is an extremely profound story. And as I'm doing research, as we're about to move into Last Temptation of Christ,
there's
a reason the story of Cain and Abel or Adam and Eve or Job, and certainly the story of the crucifixion, they stick with us forever because they are real. They're stories you can never get to the end of and go, oh, I get it.
Right.
You never get there.
Right. And they're stories of sacrifice as well.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of like the number one thing. And, you know, you asked me a few minutes ago about how the New Testament appeals. Well, it's because it is always leading to, it's a great story. It's a guy who was born, touched by God, blessed by God to be the son of God to the Virgin Mary. So there's already, this is a great story, right? You start off and you have Joseph who's like, wait a minute, what? You have to accept this through your faith. It's one of the most extreme things you can accept through your faith is that God has impregnated your virgin wife. Holy God, I have to accept this. Okay, now I got to go here. Now my son is born, and my son is really, his duty is to his overall father, which is God, not necessarily his immediate father. And then he disappears for all these years in the desert as he comes to goes through his process and comes out the other side, and he comes back to Jerusalem as a completely different person, comes back to preach the gospel, picks up 12 disciples, 12, and pulls them out of different situations in the community, and then performs miracles, and he's doubted and he's feared, and the power structure there wants to get rid of him, and they railroad him to a crucifixion. There is tragedy all across this, and it's so brilliant the way the story is written. And then at the end, he sacrifices himself, but he sacrifices himself willingly. He could have come down off the cross, but he doesn't. He knows he's got a job to do. He believes in his service. He renders that service, and then he forgives the people who are killing him with almost his last breath. And that is just an incredible story to tell. And so whoever, you know, told that story, wrote this story, created the story, adjusted and edited the story. It's a brilliant decision of how to get people on board with this, with the loving good Christ, because we've all suffered. We've all felt betrayed. We've all felt like we're people don't believe in us. And so there's a universality to that story that I think that appeals to people at a very fundamental level.
Well, and there's so many contradictions within the characters, and I mean that in the best possible way. Judas being the most important,
right?
Where Judas is the great betrayer, But Judas has to do what he has to do.
Yes.
Otherwise, there is no Christianity. Otherwise, we're not saved.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like Peter is the rock on which the church will be built, except he's, and you're going to deny me three times tonight, which he does.
Yeah.
You know, like all of those little pieces are the things that make this story so profound.
Yeah. Even the carrying of the cross, that whole thing, right? As we saw in Passion of the Christ, that whole thing is fraught with like episodes of the week. Every section of that story, the 12 stations of the cross, each one of those is a mini short film about what is going on with Jesus in the overall process of him getting to where he's going to be crucified. And so you see these all little things like Simon Peter coming in and carrying the cross. I think it's Simon Peter who carries the cross, right? This idea of Mary seeing him, like there's so much throughout the stations of the cross and what he endures and what he goes through that again just shows you that they understood what they were showing people and what they were putting together as a story to get people to come aboard this religion.
I have walked the stages of the cross.
The stations? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And it is something you would, hopefully there will be peace there in a time and you will be able to go because it will be profound. And in particular, going to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is the old, like this, it's a church and there is theoretically a piece of the original cross there. And it is one of the few places where it is a church of a Catholic church, an Eastern Orthodox and a Protestant church all living together in the same building.
Wow.
But since you brought it up, let's talk about Passion of the Christ.
Yeah.
I think I've only seen it once and I remember going to see it because everyone went,
yes,
this is anti-Semitic. And I went to see it and everyone is welcome to their opinion, of course.
Yeah.
I don't see anything remotely anti-Semitic in that movie at all. Mm. Mostly because what always bugs me is like, look, Jesus and all his apostles and Mary and all, they're all Jews.
They're all Jews.
They're all Jews. So are there Jews who are not nice people in that movie? Totally. Are there Romans who are not nice people in that movie? Totally. No one says it's anti-Latin. Right. You know, like this is what the story is.
I Rome.
I think it is a beautifully made movie. I think it is a powerful movie. Here's what I will just say. This is the epiphany I had seeing the film is that, you know, it's based on the idea of the Passion Play, which is, you know, throughout the Middle Ages, every year you would stage this play and they would show the torture of Jesus and the pain of Jesus. And clearly the most moving, or I will say among the most moving, or for many, the most moving part of the Jesus story is his suffering on the cross.
Yeah.
Right. And what leads up to it. That is the epiphany I had, because so much of that movie is just suffering, 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 suffering. Again, beautifully done, but that's what it is. Yeah. And I just went, man, I wonder if you could go back to Jesus when he was alive and say, listen, dude, because that's how I would talk to Jesus.
Sure.
I would say, but it would be in Aramaic. And I would say, listen, dude, would you prefer to be remembered for the things you said or the way you died?
Mm.
And I think he would say, I would prefer to be remembered for the things I said.
Wow. You think you know what Jesus would say? Wow.
That's what I think. Yes.
Wow.
Well, this is the thing, is like, there was very little in Passion of the Christ of love thy neighbor as thyself, or a rich man has a better chance of going through the eye of the needle than getting into the kingdom of heaven. There's so, because Jesus is truly, truly important to me as one of the great teachers of compassion and love and kindness and generosity and forgiveness. And so an hour of torture is that how you want to be remembered?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's a good question. Because, I mean, I think people do. Obviously, if you go to church every Sunday, they don't teach you the crucifixion every Sunday. It's
right,
very much about his words and his acts. If the sermon is about the New Testament that week, right? Mostly, it'll be about Jesus' words and his actions. But it's hard to, like, it's hard not to remember how he died, because the symbol of him is a cross.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Right? You know, Sam Kinison used to make a joke like, you know, I don't understand why we do this, why we walk around. And Sam was a lapsed preacher. And he said, like, I don't understand why we walk around with a symbol of the cross. Because that's like walking up to Jackie Kennedy with a rifle pendant. And I, like, when he said that, my mind went, what? And then I thought about it, actually, that's kind of true. So it is tough to talk about the actions without, when you've got the crucifix being the thing, or the cross being the thing that is the symbol of Jesus and his sacrifice and religion. And of course, I know the symbolism of it and what it's supposed to entail, but I hear your point that it is tough to just focus on the axe when the crucifixion must always be something that it follows right afterwards. So you understand what he sacrificed for your sins, what he sacrificed to open the door to heaven. You know, and I don't know that I necessarily believe that 100%. But I do believe that he was here, and I do believe he preached. I do believe he tried to make people better, and I think he tried, and through his love of humanity, and I think he was sacrificed for that. But in the end, we have to remember the lessons of what he left us with, which is very difficult to do. I mean, nowadays, brother, it is so difficult to do. I mean, people are just so angry and so hurt and so lost, and that includes me, and so desperate and willing to battle and fight and tear apart and destroy. And it just, and a lot of people doing it in God's name or in Jesus' name. And it just becomes so tough and so frustrating to remember what the core tenets of this, of that religion is, you know?
I mean, the amount of violence, torture,
yeah,
cruelty,
sure,
that has happened in this, the name of this guy who was, yeah, opposed to violence, torture, and cruelty, who was tortured to death.
Yeah.
That's that's tough. You know, that's why I always go back to, would you rather be remembered for how you died or what you said? Yeah. You know, and if we spent more time talking about what the guy said, we wouldn't be doing that other stuff, you know?
Good point. It's a good point. Yeah.
What are some of the movies that pop up for you? I have a long list in front of me, but
sure. I mean, we've talked about Passion. We've talked about Ben-Hur. We've talked about the Ten Commandments, but you know, Chariots of Fire, as we've absolutely spoken about when we did our a breakdown of that movie. I remember, as I said, and if you listen to that episode, I saw that movie 11 years old when I was in Catholic school in sixth grade, went on that field trip, and it changed my life, that movie. Like, absolutely changed my life. Ironically, I feel more of a connection with the Jewish character in the movie than I do with the Catholic character in the movie because of what Harold Abrahams has put through in that film, and Ben Cross's wonderful performance. But I remember that film being a film that kind of, how can I say this? That kind of walked two planes at the same time, the religious plane and the sports plane, and was able to to meld them together to tell this story, right? Because when he won, I wasn't yelling, go Jewish people. I was cheering for him to win. But the end result was that he was running them off their feet, and he was saying, like, you have to accept me now as an equal Jewish person. I am an equal to in your country, you know? And Eric Little was running to praise God as an extension of who he is as a person. So he was running to show how religion could give you strength in life. And so I thought that film really kind of captured a very powerful story on both sides.
It's so interesting because it's fascinating to me that there is the truly spiritual person.
Yes.
Who isn't, he's not defending, he's not running to defend his religion. His religion is a part of who he is when he runs.
Right.
You know, whereas I would say Harold Abrams, probably about as religious as me, mm-hmm, in reality, but his Jewishness and defending his Jewishness is central to who he is and what he's battling and what gives him strength. And I think there's so many movies, sports movies in particular, that have a spiritual aspect. I mean, like Rocky, his religion is important to him when he steps into the ring.
Right.
A movie like The Natural, which has no religious, nothing overtly religious, but it is all about the mythic hero and tapping into some spiritual plane that gives him strength, you know?
Well, I would argue that the ball going into the lights is the miracle because of what he's going through physically at that plate with the wounds opening up again, facing the young hurler from the Midwest, the young buck here that's going to possibly strike him out. And he is able to launch a bomb into the lights. And what does that symbolize? As you see from Glenn Close's reaction, from the kid's reaction, from the team's reaction, and the way Barry Levinson ends that sequence with the firework lights and the guys jumping up and down as the lights fade and it goes to black, it symbolizes a miracle. And they are all back in believing in faith. And I think sports is very tied to religion in that way, which is why Chariots of Fire works so well. so many people pray on the sidelines and pray in the stands. And like I was I've been watching the tournament the last week or so and watching fans just kind of put there and pray. And like you buy into this, that somehow your team is the one that's blessed by God more than the other team, or you want your team to get that miracle over the other team. Meanwhile, on the other side of the stadium, they're praying just as hard for their team because they believe these kinds of things. And you see athletes all the time say when they pull off miracle wins or they have incredible victories, like God, I praise God, all praise to God. You know, he's the one that gave me the strength to do these things. And so I always find that to be an element of these sports movies as well, Steve. It's a great point because Hoosiers certainly has that with
absolutely
multiple moments where they're praying. And even in the circle when he's like, I love you guys. And that in essence is a prayer circle. Yeah. And he is the reverend giving them knowledge or giving them love to believe in themselves, you know?
Well, this is the thing. I personally, if we just postulate that there is a God, I think it's extremely unlikely that that God is going to choose the Raiders over the Jets and pick one side. Maybe he's got a bet in. Although looking at the Jets record.
I wouldn't presume to know what God's overall plan is. And, you know, and I appreciate the fact that you came out the womb questioning things. And I totally like that about your who you are as a person, which is what makes these discussions so much fun. But like, I wouldn't presume to know, because maybe there's something here about the Raiders beating the Jets on that Sunday that leads to someone doing something down the road that's part of the overall plan. I don't know. So
look, the Lord moves in mysterious ways.
Exactly. So he could have an investment in the Raiders beating the Jets or the Jets beating the Raiders, depending on what the end result is supposed to be in order to move the ball forward.
Maybe he's got $50 on that game.
He's betting.
But this is what I was going to say is that even though I think my feeling is it's unlikely that God is picking one team, I think it's extremely likely that and this is again what my faith project is about,
yeah,
that the process of praying might help one of the teams win.
Sure. Sure.
Is that ritual, that practice puts their mind in a state that allows them to do better on the field. Since we brought up the natural, and the team of the natural is the Knights.
Yeah, the New York Knights.
I have to bring us to King Arthur.
Oh, yeah.
Not just Excalibur, not just movies, but there are so many movies that are King Arthur adjacent,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
where religion, purity, faith, sacrifice, all those things are central to them achieving whatever the quest is, you know?
Yeah, agreed. 100%. So that's the thing. And I think this is what's fascinating about your project and the way it's connected to religion and what we're talking about today is a lot of these movies are about people who are in positions, who are in lower positions of society or who are in distress. And their faith, their devotion, their dedication, their passion, and even when it's tested, and it must be tested in these films, in order for the protagonist to embrace it even more strongly so it bears fruit later on in the critical moment of the movie, I think it's about the faith that we have, right? And if it's a pure faith, I think that faith can carry you long distances, can carry you over insurmountable mountains. I believe that. I've seen faith work for me. In many, many areas of my life, I've seen faith work for me. You know, and so I absolutely, when I see those moments in film, and it may be because I saw those moments in film, I think that's also an element of this conversation that we need to touch upon, is that how much of our belief in religion is bolstered by what we see in these movies when we were growing up in our formative years, like the Ten Commandments, like Ben-Hur, like these other films that came out all around that time, even films that were challenging like Seventh Seal, you know, these conversations about God and about what his place in our life is and in our world. And when so many bad things are happening, can we really have faith in God? And you swing that over to Excalibur, the same thing, right? Is this idea of Arthur in essence, kind of being a bit of a pure person who is betrayed by Lancelot, who is his most faithful servant, kind of like Peter betraying God three times or not, you know, saying he doesn't believe in God or Jesus rather, not a friend of Jesus for three times before the cock crows. In essence, Lancelot is that. He is betraying this godlike figure in Arthur with Guinevere. And again, just like religion, you make Eve the bad person for eating the apple. You make Guinevere the bad person for sleeping with Lancelot to possibly throw Camelot in peril. And you make Morgana the evil snake, devil, demon type henchwoman who is going to try to seduce Arthur to get Mordred and then destroy the kingdom. And so when you start to go back and look at religion, you can't ignore these stories that you're talking about that influence the construction of these religions and the stories they tell within them, you know, and that's where we go to a deeper part of exploring this stuff.
Well, and like we're about to go into Last Temptation of Christ, which is a story about the human temptation of the Messiah figure and Arthur sleeping with Morgana. It's that human, those temptations, that's what corrupts Arthur and makes it impossible for him to seek the Grail. You mentioned that, you know, faith helps you get through the thing you have to get through. I mean, let's talk about what I know is one of your most favorite movies, which is Gandhi.
Yeah.
You know, Gandhi doesn't exist without faith.
Yeah.
100%. He can't get there. You have to, and people don't in general, and the same we can say of Martin Luther King, in general, you don't face the fire hoses and the brutal beatings and the possibility of you getting killed. I'm not saying that atheists don't do those things. I think they do those things.
Yeah.
But I think part of what makes it possible is, or makes it easier, is faith, you know?
Yeah. I don't want to speak out of turn of this, but I can't think of leaders that caused massive changes in our world, not in just a country, but in our world, by their movements that weren't in some way connected to religion, whether they were religious leaders or believed in a certain religion and that was what guided them into. So I don't know. Like, I don't have the knowledge necessarily to pin down every leader who overturned, communism or overturned these negative forces in our world, you know, because that's the thing is like, well, what's the strength and what allows you to do it? It is your faith. And with Gandhi, that's a 3-hour treatise on faith. And he is tested at every step of the way, from a young man being kicked off that train to putting this together. And it's not easy. He has the fight with his wife over the latrines and what have you. And he has to also starve himself and make these decisions. And he makes these decisions because there is something that is motivating him to make this, something intrinsic about him and his connection to God, his connection to his faith that motivates him to, or to his gods, I'm sorry, that motivates him to make these decisions, that he thinks he's making the right decisions, to sacrifice his life or put his life in danger with the fasting in order to make these changes that he wants to make in the world. And so, that film carries so much resonance for me because it's a film that I envy. That I wish I could have that kind of resolve and commitment to my faith to lead a movement like that to change this world for the better. But I am too flawed. And in the end, I think those films help us to feel that those things are possible. And you hope to find someone who will do that one day again, you know.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, another one we've done on the show, which, you know, people might have different feelings about this guy, but Malcolm X is a story. That person, faith is unquestionably what saves him. And then faith is also this thing that leads him away from the organization that saved him.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, because again, here is what is presented to us in the movie as a man who was caught up in doing all kinds of negative things and then has this incredibly moving and powerful convergence in the prison. Dude, the way Spike shoots that scene, I cry every time he is converted. And then when he goes to meet Elijah, it is as if he is meeting God himself,
dude.
Right? The way they light Denzel and that tear coming down his cheek, you're just so, and you've never seen Denzel be in a submissive position. And to see him be so submissive to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in that scene is so devastating. And then, of course, he is kind of a Jesus figure in that he is trying to lead his people to a better understanding of the world. And he initially leads with anger and violence and pushback and all of that. And in terms of defense, right? I'm not saying that he initiates. I'm saying defense. But when he goes on that pilgrimage, which Spike shoots so well as well, when he comes back out, he's a different person and he wants to work with everyone. He wants equality of all. And then he is murdered just when he is about to change the world, which a lot of people feel like that. A lot of our religious leaders or a lot of our leaders who make these movements die. I mean, in a way, Lincoln is kind of like a symbol of this kind of, religious father figure who is leading us out of this time of turmoil and who stays the course and who keeps the faith in the country. His faith is in the union of the country. And what he does, right? And we see that in Lincoln and we see that in other things. Does he cross lines? Does he twist some arms? Does he make comments like, if I could release all the slaves, I would, and it would stop the war. If I could keep all the slaves, I would let that all happen if it stopped the war. To him, the faith was in the Union and the things that he does. And so I find such incredible similarities in these people who were put in some insane situations and kind of relied on their faith or their belief in themselves in order to navigate them, and sadly with tragic results for themselves personally.
Two thoughts. One is the there, particularly because we're doing about to do Last Temptation of Christ, which is that there's the human struggling with the human things.
Sure.
And then there is the way that the martyr is idolized or sainted after they're gone.
Yeah.
Lincoln was a human struggling with human things, but he also was Father Abraham, you know?
Right.
Like, and so, Ken, you know, we did just a JFK. JFK is a perfect example of a very, very human figure that then became sainted because he was of how he died.
Yeah. And that had that song. What was that 60 song, Abraham, Martin, and John? I mean,
exactly.
That's a great song from, I forget the artist who sings that, but yeah.
The one I know, the James Taylor version. I don't know if his is.
Oh, Dion sings.
That's who it is. Yeah. So, I would like to go now from the, we've said some wonderful things about the greatest humans ever around.
Yeah.
You know where else that religious plays a huge part? Is horror movies.
Hey, right.
Is The Exorcist scares the crap out of me.
Sure.
Partially because it is dealing with these religious themes.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, if the God stuff is true, well, it's really both. Because it's like, well, if this kid is really possessed by a demon, then this whole structure of the universe that I, as an atheist, have been denying, I'm wrong. There's some demons that are coming to get us. And it's really scary.
This is based on a true story. So,
yeah-ish.
I mean, I want you to go to an exorcism. I think this would be good for you to see something like this, to maybe explore something like this. And so I think this should be a part of your project. As you said, it's going to be many years. You sitting in multiple exorcisms to see if this makes you question your atheism, I think would be great. Because I think your atheism should be tested as strongly as other people's faith is tested. I think that's fair.
Sure.
Yeah. Be interesting to see that. Also, Carrie has that, right, Steve?
Yeah, totally.
With her mother being so religious. And that's taking religion to where it's an extension of your own desires to control the world. And you hide behind your religion, or you use your religion to actually implement your own personal points of views on people. And I think that's where Carrie is a cautionary tale to religion, to people of religion, of how far they can take this belief in God to where they're committing these horrible acts to the children of God because they think that they are demonic or possessed, right? And of course, at its base level, it's about the period and becoming a woman and all of this and how that can affect a mother's perception of their child and how they deal with their child. But the fact that she's overtly religious and the manner which Carrie kills her, which is in essence a sacrifice, a crucifixion, is there. You can't escape the symbolism that's going on there.
I absolutely agree. And I also think too, like, I won't say every single vampire movie, but the vast majority of vampire movies essentially prove that Christianity is true. You know what I mean? Because if the cross works, if holy water works, well, then that means that that's true. Well, right. and it's so funny because all of the stories of devils and vampires and things, they exist within a structure created by the Catholic Church, even if it's like, I would say, like the negative space.
Yeah.
It's like, here's the structure. Well, it's interesting too, as I've been reading and studying, is like so much of our ideas, particularly of hell and the devil and all that stuff, that's not in the Bible. That is stuff that's in Dante and Milton and in Hieronymus Bosch paintings. That's the creations of a thousand years after the Bible. Those, you know, and like there are references to Satan and to things like that in the serpent and things like that. But the way we've connected them all, that's stuff that came after, and it's all built into particularly horror movies, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and you see that. And I think that's why I have a tough time with certain horror movies, especially when they deal with religion, because that is so deep ingrained in me that that's a possibility that it makes it tough to watch some of those movies, because those visions stay with you. Those images stay with you, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
You know, John, I don't have to tell you that I had a pretty rough month last month. I had family commitments, work stuff was a bit overwhelming, and frankly, my battery felt drained. And one of the ways that I looked to charge up that battery came through therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve, you know, you and I have both spoken about our therapy journeys here on the show. Certainly for me, one of the things that got me back in recharged, got me back connected to life, got me back ready to go and take control of my life was therapy. Once you go deep and find out what's going on, it's amazing how much more energetic, how much more you're willing to take part in your life. And therapy helps you do that for sure.
So if you're thinking of starting therapy, I'd give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/cinephiles today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/cinephiles.
I have one more movie, which is a movie that you and I both watched for the first time over the summer, which is how people use religion for their own advantage. And that's Night of the Hunter.
Oh, yeah. Right. Another film where a preacher, a false preacher, false prophet, right, takes advantage of God, takes advantage of people's goodwill, takes advantage of people's belief in God to manipulate them and twist them, and also taking advantage of the inherent patriarchy of religion, the inherent sexism of religion at times, to make the woman lesser than, to make the woman a harlot, to make the woman question her moral character question, but not the male character question, you know? So there's all of that that's mixed into Night of the Hunter that I think is a nice concoction in our conversation and seeing how one man can come in because it's a patriarchal setup to step in, and he has just taken his word is just taken as bond because he simply has a collar around his neck, right?
Exactly.
The exploration of that is how much power do we give people who are supposedly representing religion? How many of them are shysters? How many of them are liars? How many of them are sociopaths who use God to fatten their wallets? And how many people get sucked into that to be a part of it? So, I love that that was explored so powerfully in Night of the Hunter.
Well, and it's interesting because like when you watch Ben-Hur, you watch the Ten Commandments, you're in the world of the religion and the religion is real.
Right.
When you watch The Exorcist or you know, a vampire movie or King Arthur, you're to some degree in the world of the religion is real. Right. When you watch Chariots of Fire or you watch Night of the Hunter, you're in the world of religious people in our world.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like there's no magic happens in them. We don't actually see things that are specifically religious, but the belief of the characters is critical to the story, particularly obviously with Eric Little character and definitely Lillian Gish, her connection to her religion is absolutely central to her life and who she is and how she's going to protect these kids.
Right. Yes. Cause she is administering religion correctly, which is to help the little ones, keep them from harm, guide them to life, try to give them the right proper lessons to exist in a life full of demons. And so, yeah.
Exactly. It's religion as a tool.
Yep.
This is, and of course she believes that it's 100% true, and her experience of her life bears that out, yep. You know?
Right.
It's funny. So Night of the Hunter has the preacher that's a danger, that's a threat, mm-hmm. who's using religion to control. Another one of the movies, religious movies that were central to me as a kid that we did a few years ago on the Cinephiles is Oh God.
Yes, please.
Because Oh God is it. Here's the prophet. And here's one where this is in the religion. Religion is 100% true in that movie because this is really God. And you have people really trying to do the right thing. And I'm telling you, there are very few movies, I would say, other than things like Star Trek, there are very few movies that have so much of what is at my moral core as Oh God does. Oh God, it's just like lays out so much about just be good to each other, take care of the planet, be kind, have a sense of humor, like, you know, treat your kids well. All these things are like, yes, these are my core beliefs. And they're come out of George Burns' mouth.
I wonder how Oh God would be received today. I wonder
Jackson loved it.
Yeah,
loved it.
Yeah. But I wonder how the reaction would be for people who are what I feel lately are trying to use religion for their own benefits. I wonder what reaction would be to a film that essentially speaks to the New Testament approach to the world, which is not judgment. It's acceptance and love and creating space to accept everyone for who they are and find a way to get along. Whereas Paul Sorvino's character and the other characters there who are connected to the religion, in essence, a new Pharisees, are trying to crucify Christ all over again,
exactly.
Trying to find God guilty in the courtroom, right?
Yep.
And still won't believe it when he walks out because they can't believe it because it's against what they need to have as a narrative in order to keep fleecing people of their money with the things that they say. And so I think there's a very strong strain throughout that movie about judging for yourself who are the real people representing religion and God and who are the ones that are not. But I want to move to someplace else because, Steve, you've spent almost an hour here on this conversation. You've conveniently not spoken about Holocaust films, as I know that's not an easy thing for you to discuss, but there's religion all through those Holocaust films, right? Like Schindler's List and what have you. Even, I guess not Zone of Interest, I guess, but other Holocaust films.
Yeah, not much religion in Zone of Interest.
More demonic than there is religion. But like the idea of religion being something that Jewish people rely on in these movies and in these horrible situation that was the Holocaust. Can you speak on that growing up even as an atheist, how that was something very powerful to see? Because it's a fascinating thing to grow up as an atheist who is Jewish, because Jewish faith is such a big part of how people survive the Holocaust according to what you see in the movies and TV shows.
It's funny because Jewish atheism is also deeply connected to the Holocaust because so many people went into the camps and we're going to talk about this when we get to Last Temptation of Christ.
Yeah.
But the promise of the Torah, of the Old Testament, is that Jews are God's chosen people, yes, and will be placed in dominion on earth, and the Messiah will sit on the throne, you know? And that waiting for that to happen after the temple had fallen and all of the things and the conquering of Palestine by the Romans, you know, part of why Judas is so pissed off at the beginning of Last Temptation of Christ is because he's trying to create that. When do we get that? You know? And so what happens in the Holocaust is a lot of Jews went basically, oh, this was all bullshit. Wow. If this can happen to us. Oh, there's a huge.
Really?
Absolutely. I didn't know that, Steve. Absolutely.
Please, speak on this more. I did not know that.
Well, and there's, you know, you see it in, I can't remember if we see it in Schindler's List, but you definitely see it in Holocaust films where there's the old rabbi who's, you know, still doing his prayers and trying to rally them. And then there's, you know, there's a long connection between Judaism and communism. And so there's, because that was part of one of the most brilliant things, by the way. This is just something I had read recently in terms of anti-Semitism, and I'm saying brilliant anti-Semitism is horrible. But one of the things that, and you still see it today, is that Jews will be attacked, and this is what Hitler did, for A, being people who are only interested in money, who are trying to control the world through the banks and things like that, and simultaneously be attacked for being communists who are trying to destroy property. And you will see, and this is still happening today, is that you can't trust Jews because they're communists who don't care about money, and you can't trust Jews because they're capitalists and all they care about is money. But anyway, in the concentration camp, there's always the character who's saying, why are you praying? Why, if there was a God, would we be here? If we're his chosen people, would we be here? Like, if God has, one of the basic questions, atheist questions, is if God is all good, how can he allow things like the Holocaust to happen? You know, and
fascinating to me because the Bible is full, especially the Old Testament is full of
terrible, horrible things.
Yeah, Jewish people have to overcome in order to, you know, find their promised land, find their homeland. The Ten Commandments story, all the things that they had to endure for what, centuries for decades before Moses, you know, discovered who he was and led them out of.
But it is also a story of Jewish triumph.
Yes. You know? Yes.
And if you read, you know, Elie Wiesel's Night, which I've read multiple times, and the wrestling with religion, and, you know, Night to some degree is about, oh, there's nothing in the night sky. We are alone as humans. We are all alone, you know? Funny. I did write down Schindler's List and I did write down Night, but I didn't write down Holocaust films. But in the worst things that happen to humans, this is where faith is tested, and maybe this is often where faith is born, you know?
Yeah. Or as you just pointed out, which I didn't know about, dashed to the rocks or rejected or crushed.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, obviously, and I think that event, that those movies that really capture that and show all the multifaceted sides of people's points of views as they're experiencing that. Because it, as we've seen in multiple films, like, and read in the history books, like, Jewish people were legitimately shocked at the level of hate and anger that they endured at the hands of the Nazis in multiple countries. Like, there was a legit, like, there was, it's always been anti-Semitism, right? And so that's always popped up. If you look at artwork, you look at whatever, you can find shades of anti-Semitism in literature from all those times before the Holocaust, before 1941 or whenever we started putting, in 1938, 39, we started building those camps. You can find that. So clearly that anti-Semitism was a very huge part of how people perceived Jewish people. And then here comes one person who is willing to go to that next level and in such horrific ways. And so I think Jewish people, if I'm, my analysis and opinion, if it has any value here, you know, whatever I'm saying, is basically like there was an acceptance that there was anti-Semitism, but there was not a belief that it was going to go the way it went, right? And I think that's where perhaps the questioning of faith and questioning about, like, you hit a breaking point. And so it does make sense that atheism would have been, Jewish atheism would have been born out of the Holocaust.
I think here's a metaphor, and then I have a much lighter direction to take our conversation. Yeah. I always thought, like, you know, after September 11th, and they put all the security at the pilot's door and someone would to prevent this thing from happening again. And my feeling has generally been the odds are very slim of it happening again, because previous to 9/11, when someone hijacked a plane, that plane would end up landing.
Right. Yes.
And so no one expected that they were going to hijack the plane and fly it into a building.
Right.
Once you see that someone might do that, the whole way we do everything changes.
Yep.
Jewish, there's anti-Semitism for thousands of years since the diaspora.
Yeah.
We have been attacked over and over and over again in all sorts of countries all over the world, and we have always endured and survived. Yeah. And it always has gone, they've done terrible things, but they left us alive, enough of us alive to keep going. And the thing about the Holocaust was, the goal is not to do, it's not just that they're gonna, the Cossacks are gonna come in and raid the village and there will be rape and violence and then they'll leave and we'll rebuild. That's not what the Holocaust is. The Holocaust is there will be no one left.
Eradication.
Yep.
Eradication.
Systematic, mechanized, highly organized eradication.
Yeah.
That's a whole other thing.
And sometimes that's, and we've seen that as an undercurrent born in certain religions to destroy the Jewish world, which I think is antithetical to what religion is supposed to be. You know, we see that in certain moments in the movies. And, you know, we could even, if we wanted to, you wanted to go on a lighter note, please take us away.
Well, I'll try to. I mean, like,
into a wormhole. This will be a 45-minute thing. I mean, what about religion in, like, the mobster films? Like, that is a big part of mobster films, the crossing of the cross, or they're wearing crosses, or they've got pictures of Jesus. We just did Goodfellas, and his mom had a picture of Christ up there. And so, like, they, Pesci's mom in the film. And so what do you think about that? Like, because you read about mafia stuff and it is Italians very tied to religion and Catholicism, Christianity, what have you. What are your thoughts on that?
I'll tell you, there's one scene, an incredible montage that my brain instantly went to as soon as you asked this question. Yeah. And I think it sums almost everything up. And it relates to what we talked about with using Christ's name in the Crusades or in the Spanish Inquisition or all the other times that people have used religion for nasty stuff. And that is the baptism of Michael Corleone's child.
Oh, yeah.
While they are assassinating him. And that is like, you are literally in the church, your baby in your hand, saying you're renouncing Satan while committing that kind of cognitive dissonance, you know, but that it's just like, what's so crazy about it is that's normal. That is, you know, like America has carried the cross into war, all sorts of people. There are all sorts of people right now who are calling for violence for one reason or another because their religion told them so.
Yeah, that's a great point, right? Because people look at that scene, even people who are Catholic, and deep into their religion, they look at that scene and that's a badass scene to them. That's a man wiping out the four other rivals or the five other rivals, if you include Mo Green, so that he can take control. And in essence, we're kind of cheering for Michael by the end of the movie, right? He killed Carlo. We're cheering for Michael as he's doing these things. But what Coppola was wanting to show was the hypocrisy, right? Yeah. In that scene is like, here is a guy who is blessing, getting Connie's child baptized, and he is murdering people all over the place so that he can have control of crime and the crime syndicates in New York. So it's this hypocrisy inherent within the world of organized crime with the connection to religion. And so I thought that was such a genius move by Coppola, because it is a badass moment if you're looking at it objectively. But it also is a moment where you go, oh, wow, yeah, these are the kind of compromises that these people make in positions of power in order to carry out the things that they carry out, you know?
I mean, Richard the Lionheart was a badass as he, you know, put the cross on his chest and rode off to take the Holy Lands from the heretics.
Yeah, the Crusades.
You know, it's like, and frequently stopped off and killed a bunch of Jews along the way, and then killed a bunch of babies and raped a lot of women and, you know, got the cross in our arms, you know?
People don't want to hear about that. People don't want to hear about that.
Because the name Richard the Lionheart, I mean, that sounds really, really cool. Okay, now let's move away from some of these heavier things. Okay. One more. Sure. How many movies, particularly in science fiction and superhero movies, is there a character who what they really need to do is have faith in the power that's within them in order for them to conquer them? And I will start with use the Force, Luke, in Star Wars.
Sure.
That is central 100%. Faith. Let go of your logical mind. Use the Force and it'll grant you all these powers. We've seen it in Thor, in The Matrix, a classic one from my youth, The Last Dragon.
Oh,
where
yeah.
You have the power. The
Last Dragon.
Bruce Leroy. Like, oh, there's so many movies, but those are religious themes. Like, if you have faith, you'll gain great power and be able to be a force for good.
Yeah. And because no matter what we think about our society, and certainly the numbers for atheism are rising, which are what's causing people to be even more hardcore about religion and be more vocal about the need for us to embrace God. Our country is very steeped in the connection to Christianity and Catholicism, right? It's very steeped in it. I mean, God is on the money, you know, it's a very big deal, right? No matter what they say, people pray before they go out and play sports matches. Like, there's all kinds of stuff where religion is an inherent part of our society and how we build her. So this idea of, you know, having the faith in yourself, that's just an extension of that. It's an extension. Because if you believe that you are a child of God, a creature of God, if you believe that deeply, that God has given you these talents, God has given you these things, then you find the way to have faith in yourself, because in a way, having faith in yourself is an extension of your faith in God. And so you see that in a lot of these movies. And I think that's both comedies comedies, dramas, horror movies, what have you, that's an inherent part of the protagonist sometimes in some of these stories, which I think is very symbolic of faith. Even if it doesn't overtly say it's faith-based, it's very much faith adjacent, if nothing else.
I think it's a huge... It is so central to how we see heroism and myth and all these things. Is this moment, the moment of truth where the person believes in themselves.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's Thor showing up suddenly with the lightning coming out of his hand.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like all that stuff that works there. Another area that in science fiction is that science fiction likes to explore ideas of, do we have a soul and what is the nature of life?
Right.
You look at movies like Her, or 2001, or RoboCop, you know, or there are a whole bunch of movies where it's like, is there some ineffable, powerful quality that is elevated above just the day-to-day world, you know?
Yeah, Blade Runner.
Certainly. Blade Runner, 100%.
Right? I mean, and also even now we've seen Star Wars fans, you know, speak about justice for droids. This idea, are droids sentient creatures, or are they not sentient creatures? Why does the Star Wars franchise sometimes treat these droids so terribly as if they're not sentient beings? And so
which they clearly are.
Well, exactly.
They are.
But the way they get discarded or the way they get stomped on or destroyed, there's not a moment of pause of like sadness, unless like R2-D2 were to die or something. God forbid. That's when you'd have a real kind of funeral and moment of tragedy and everyone reacts to it. But we see droids getting stepped on, destroyed, run over, burnt up, and all that throughout every installment of the Star Wars franchise, yet there's no pausing to love the droid. You know what I'm saying? And I think that's an element of where people are discovering these conversations or, you know, enjoying these conversations in sci-fi about how, what does it mean to be quote unquote human? What does it mean to exist? What does it mean to meet your creator, as we see in Blade Runner? And his desire is to kill his creator for giving him such a limited amount of life, right? And in a way, he symbolizes what a lot of people feel when they are surprised to find out that they've got a disease. Because there is some people who go through this anger, especially people of faith, go through this anger at God. Why have you given me this? Other people go, okay, I've got to tackle this. This is my latest test for my faith. And I say this as something I told you about years ago when my father was dying of cancer. There was a moment, a conversation I will always remember near the end of my father's days where he wanted to take his own life. And this is a deeply religious man, but the pain of the mesothelioma, which had just absolutely bloated him. They had pulled out, they had surgically removed his right lung and filled it with a bag. My mother and sister had to dress the side of the wound, which in essence was almost like a Christ wound from the stab, is just gaping. And every day in the morning and night, they had to dress that wound in order to keep it clean so it wouldn't get infected before it eventually closed. It was a massive wound when I say gaping. And so this is all he endured. And one day in a moment of crisis, and he asked me, and I'm going to try to say this without getting emotional. And he asked me like, you know, I want to end my life. I don't want to endure this anymore. And I, in that moment, you know, I said to him, you've fought all the way here. You have just a few more steps to go and you'll be in the promised land and you'll be accepted by God. You'll get to heaven and you'll be there because you didn't take that route. And like, that was a very tough conversation to have. And then a week later, after I'd gone home, he passed. And so in that moment, it's almost as if even my father had questioned his faith and the religion and all these years and time and hours and minutes and seconds that were spent reading the Bible, talking about God, religion, whatever you, even in that moment, he questioned his faith, but our conversation brought him back to level. And he was able to keep going until he passed naturally from the cancer. And so that is something that I think endures in all these movies, this idea of this crisis of faith. How do I climb through this? How do I achieve what I need to achieve when I'm at the lowest moments that I can be in my life, whether it's physically or emotionally? How do I climb out of it? You know? And so I think that's a huge element that is faith adjacent that I enjoy in these movies.
So thank you for sharing all of that. And you had told me some of that before, but you hadn't told me all of it. And in the context of what I learned about your dad at the beginning of our conversation, I think what you did was brave and hard and absolutely the right decision for who your dad was. Yeah. That it was important. His faith was so important to him, and that to fight those last few days, as painful as it was, I'm glad. And now I will share, I had the exact opposite conversation with my dad when he was dying of ALS.
Yeah.
And ALS is such a terrible disease, and you can end up for a really long time just totally paralyzed, unable to speak, unable to communicate, you know, and slowly your lungs getting weaker and weaker until you eventually die. That I said to my dad, hey, if there's a time that you want out, you let me know and I will make it happen.
Yeah.
I didn't know how I was going to make it happen, but I was like, I will try to figure this out. And he said, I will let you know. And then he ended up, my dad, you know, I think early on, he kind of thought, oh, when this happens, I won't want to live any longer. Mm-mm. But he fought right till the end, you know.
That's funny, right? Like you see that. And I think you did the right thing for your father. And I think you're right to say that I did the right thing for my father. And I don't mean that from an arrogant point of view. I mean, like this, I had to, it was my job to put him back on course, right? It was
for him. Yeah.
Yeah, for him, because of the situation and then what I knew about my father. If my father had come to me and legitimately was in tears and saying, John, it's time. I want to go. Then I would have to fight my entire family and we would do it. Because my brother did not want to let go of my dad. He tried to find all these weird cures and whatever, and there was never going to be any cure. And so I would, if he had said to me, and I felt that it was an honest request from deep in his heart and his soul, that this was what he wanted, then I would have moved heaven and earth to make it happen.
Right.
But I knew that was the right decision in that moment. And the fact that he stabilized, and he thanked me later because he tried to have that conversation with my brother, with my sister, with my mom, and they all rejected the conversation. They wouldn't even entertain the idea. And I just knew he wanted just someone to talk to, because I'm like that sometimes. So I knew that that was going to, and I think what you did was the right thing for your father, because very practical, you're a pragmatic person, and you understood, like, if it gets too much, this is a gift I can give you and make this happen. Yeah,
exactly.
Totally understand.
Sure. Well, and I think this is why we come back to these religious movies, because they engage you in these extremely difficult moments of time.
Yeah.
And they're moments of time which my logical not that I'm entirely logical or rational, but that my approach doesn't always give you tools to face.
Yeah.
You know, right. Like, well, and it also goes back to, like, the reason I love stories is stories are ways of engaging and exploring and playing with the ideas of what it is to be alive.
Right. Yes.
You know what I mean? And these religious stories have been around for a long time because they're really, really good at doing that.
Yeah.
And frequently, because they're the story of Job in particular is a story where, like, you just can never get to the end of that story.
No.
There's no place you can end up and go, I got it. This is what this is about. You can't. You can't. I mean, Cain and Abel, you can't get to the end of that. The entire book, East of Eden, which is my favorite Steinbeck book, to a large degree, is an exploration of fathers and sons and brothers and the Cain and Abel story and Adam.
Yeah.
You know, and what all that means. We're going to continue to wrestle with this stuff. And it's wrestling with this stuff that is the foundation of how you talk to your dad and how I talk to my dad. You know?
Yeah. This is the lighter portion of the show.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think it's also important to remember, like, what's great about these religious films and these religious shows, and when they're done really well, they make us question. Like, I love that Seventh Seal is a conversation about death, right? Those are those things that we come to terms with, which are connected to what you and I just shared here. But yeah, this idea of questioning of what it is. Even something like Dogma, which is inherently a comedy, is a conversation about questioning religion. And I like these films that challenge their protagonists or antagonists and their religion and test their faith and have these questions. And most of the times they come out even stronger in their beliefs, but some of the times they don't. And I kind of like that, because that's real life. That's reality. And I enjoy that when films are done really well, they have those explorations. And I also think religious comedies are super important in order so we don't take it all so fucking seriously. And I think that's a great part of films as well, that when they're done well, like Bruce Almighty, like funny little comedies like that, I think work really well. Or Heaven Can Wait, which I thought was really good. I don't think Holy Moses was that good of a comedy, but it had this. Or Life of Brian, which we talked about on the show. And by the way, randomly, I went down a wormhole where I had no idea that Cleese and Michael Palin went toe-to-toe with, like, a reverend.
Oh, yeah. It's a great one, isn't it?
Holy God, that was a fantastic watch. If you guys haven't seen it, it's on YouTube. You should watch it on YouTube. It's a great back and forth where the priest and the reverend think they're members of the fucking Mighty Python crew, and it's Cleese and Palin who are being much more serious in their approach to religion, defending the life of Brian, which I thought was a great commentary on how people of faith sometimes make have issues with certain films on purpose in order to get people to be even more committed to the faith, and in a way manipulate the situation so they can benefit from it financially and what have you. And I thought watching these guys make jokes throughout the whole situation showed me that this was a bad faith thing, in my opinion.
Bad jokes. What's so funny about that video, and I remember it so well, is that it's like, they showed up thinking, we're going to, these guys are just a bunch of dumb comics,
not comedians.
And we're just going to make fun of them. And it's going to be a funny little conversation. Yeah. And Cleese and Palin, they showed up to a fight.
Yes.
They were ready. They were prepared.
And like weeks researching passages. And I wanted to be able to recall anything he needed to recall to go counter it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No. That's great. And Life of Brian, and it's so funny that is that what the objections, because I remember when we did the show, the objections are like, they didn't understand what the movie was. They hadn't seen the movie.
Of course.
The movie is not attacking Christ. Yeah. The movie is attacking the things that we've talked. The movie is way more against what's his name in Night of the Hunter and all the hypocrisy around religion. It's not about the actual religion itself. It's about humans. Well, and this is where we get into all the trouble. And again, I go back to the things that Jesus said. And then you look at all the ways that people followed him, where he must be going like, hey, guys, hey, fellas, I think you misunderstood what I was. Why is there all this gold in the Vatican? Like, didn't you hear the stuff about being rich? Like, what's going on?
Yeah, you know, I think if Christ ever really returned, I think there would be a reckoning like we've never seen. But I also think the people, because as we see now, Steve, up is down, black is white. No one wants to believe anything universally anymore. Like the earth is round and all this stuff. I think the same people of faith who are screaming about Jesus coming back, if Jesus ever came back, I think they would not believe him. And I think they would absolutely, no matter what he showed them, like we saw in Oh God, Oh God, in essence, was a commentary about Christ coming back to earth. And that the people who are invested in Christ, in saying that Christ is coming back to earth because they're making so much money off of it, won't ever accept Christ coming back to earth because it ruins their narrative and it ruins their cash windfall. And I think there are people like that. And I hope someday there's a comedy. I think there's been a comedy. Like, I think Brother from Another Planet was a version of that. But I'd like to see something that was mainstream done by a studio that was willing to kind of put that story into a real world context and see how, and have the guts to tell the story of how people would actually react, both good and bad, to the situation.
I think people would. I'm all for it. I mean, it's sort of the Grand Inquisitor sequence in Brothers Karamazov, which is Jesus comes back during the Inquisition and is having a conversation with the Grand Inquisitor, and in the end, they have to kill him because he's going to ruin everything.
You can't. What are you doing? Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I feel like this is a great conversation, and I really, really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for suggesting it. And I just feel like maybe this is a thing we'll return to again with other themes, but it just struck me so strongly when we started talking about it. It's like, oh, this infiltrates so much of storytelling in our world, even all sorts of stories like science fiction ones, where you're not really thinking about religion. Mm. And yet and it's funny too, you know, I'm a Jewish guy, but I grew up in America. And so the connection to Christian themes and Christian ideas is just almost written into my DNA. And so I think this is a really powerful road to walk down, I felt.
Yeah, I thought so too. And I applaud you for being willing to have this conversation. And to anybody who's listening to us, if Steve and I have said anything that might have hurt you or offended you, trust me that we are both coming from a good place about it, that we're both coming from trying to be considerate and caring and intelligent in our analysis and our exploration of these films and our points of views that were coming out about these films. So just want to make sure that you understand our inherent intention in the conversation and our inherent intention in these back and forths about these movies and our thoughts on these movies. So just want to make sure we make that very clear. We respect everyone's religion. We respect your beliefs, your faiths, whatever, and if you don't believe, especially, we respect that as well. We just felt this would be a nice conversation to have here before we tackle a very controversial film in Last Temptation of Christ and go through everything in that.
I just want to echo everything you said.
Yeah,
I really, from the kind of arrogant atheist guy I might have been 30 years ago, I think life is hard.
Yeah.
And whatever helps you get through life, whatever set of beliefs, as long as you're not hurting other people with them, you have 100% my support. I know John feels the same way.
100%.
I'll say there's some religious holidays coming up, all sorts of different ones. And I hope that you enjoy them and celebrate them if they are your thing. And of course, we'd love to hear your thoughts on all this. You can visit us on our Facebook page. Just do a search for The Cinephiles. It's @Cine_files on Twitter, The Cinephiles Podcast on Instagram. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, all the usual places. If you want to support the show, you can do it either through Apple Podcasts, through their subscriptions there. You can also support us on patreon.com/TheCinephiles. And if you want to buy or stream every movie we've ever reviewed, that's at cinephiles.net. And I am at SR Morris on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram. John, how would they find you?
You can always find me at The Roca Says on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, The Outlaw Nation on Twitch, my YouTube channel, youtube.com/John Roca Says, and my other podcasts, The Hot Mic, The Geek Buddies, and The Outlaw Nation Podcast Network that are out there for you all to enjoy and have some fun with. And if I can throw a plug in too for our Shogun reviews, for those of you who've maybe not heard about it or started watching it, don't forget to watch our reviews that are on my YouTube channel, but you can also listen to our reviews on this Cinephiles podcast feed. And as you're listening to us, we are wrapping up our 10 days of Oscars. We probably just dropped Anatomy of a Fall, Zone of Interest, and then Poor Things will drop this weekend, and that will wrap up our 10 days of Oscars. So also look for those on the YouTube channel and on the podcast feed.
And after checking all of those out, you can come back right here next week as we continue this season of Scorsese with a very, very deep dive into The Last Temptation of Christ.